welcome to episode 39 of our podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Gregg, and I'm here today, as always, with the sterling Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry?
Very good, thank you, David. Very good indeed. It's a day today that we can celebrate. Victoria had zero infections recorded and zero deaths from COVID, which is a massive, massive turnaround, which is great. So that's good.
It's terrific. It probably won't hold the because there are some other infections out there. We probably get a few more over the next couple of days, but it's certainly a fantastic target to hit. There's no question about that.
It is indeed. And I think that's all we'll talk about for the plague.
Yeah, we've had enough talking about the plague, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Sure. So I had a question for you, Perry, which I thought I would ask. It comes up because I've sort of been looking at getting hold of some new books to read, particularly in the crime genre. And I wanted to ask you, when a new book comes out by an author you like, do you buy a physical book or do you buy an e-book?
That's a good question. It depends on who in the house is going to read it. If it's just me, it'll probably be an e-book. If it's both my wife and I, it will be a physical copy. So, for example, coming up later in the year is a new Gary Disher novel. Now, I'll probably buy at least two copies of that, one for myself and probably one for my stepmother as well, because she's quite keen on Disher. Not that she reads much in the way of crime novels. She just likes the location in which these are set, because it's only about 30, 40 kilometres away from where she lived for like 20 or 30 years. So she really quite likes that. If it's a science fiction novel, for example, the new Kim Stanley Robinson, Ministry of the Future, I bought that in hardcover. So I got into it quickly because I want to read that one hopefully sometime later this year when I can fit it in into your arduous schedule that you keep setting for me, David.
You keep saying it's my arduous schedule. I don't know about that.
I've got to blame somebody. No, it actually sort of loosens up a bit from here on in, as we'll probably mention later on in the program.
Yeah, we're trying to loosen it up. Yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah, it's been a bit fraught over the last 6 weeks or so.
Too prescriptive, anyway. Too demanding of what we had to read. Yeah,
but very interesting, just the same.
Yeah,
I'm not going to poo-poo any of the stuff that we read. It's just that sometimes you want to sort of spread things around a bit. So, if it's a favourite author of mine, well, then I would buy a hardcover. So whatever Le Guin published, I bought a hardcover copy of that. If Robinson writes something, I'll buy a hardcover copy of that. So there's no hard and fast rule, but generally speaking, if my wife and I are going to read it, then basically I'll buy it in a printed version. Otherwise, it'll be an e-book version.
Sure, I understand. Yeah, for me, it's... I've been tending to buy ebooks, certainly of fiction, mostly unless it's like a really new book by an author, and I know I'm going to want to read that book again and again, and maybe lend it to other people. Then I'll buy a physical copy, and like you, I try to, if I can afford it, I go for the hardback because it's much more durable. But if it's just in a series of fiction, I've been reading like a series of crime novels or so on, I tend to buy the ebook. The other reason about that, of course, I don't have any more room on my shelves anymore. And of course, the ebooks are good that way.
That is a big problem. When you've been buying books, when you're the age that we are, David, and you've been buying books for 50 years, the house is full. Yeah. I know that it's been pointed out to me that I've got a long hallway that I could fill up with bookshelves. I did that when we first moved in here, and my wife was not very impressed with it. And so that was got short shrift very quickly, had to get rid of all of that. So we had to put some built-in shelves in. And, of course, as soon as you put in a floor-to-ceiling bookshelves in one room, fills up straight away.
Absolutely, yeah.
Put another bookshelf in, and people come in and say, oh, you got a lot of books there. And you go, yeah, it's all a bit of a problem. And these are doubled up as well. And
they go, oh, goodness.
And they go, what?
I've reached that point.
Oh, yeah. So you've got books stacked behind books. So
no, I don't like
that. The books at the front that you can see are just the ones that I might want to come back to, or I might want you to have to see. Not that I'm there to try and impress people, but there's that great book title from the Anthony Powell, Powell novel, "Books Do Furnish a Room," and they do, and they make a very good point or furnishing in a room. And I always know that when I go around to somebody's place that I've never been to before, I'll generally end up with a glass of red in my hand, and you'll see me very soon over there at the bookshelf just browsing around, seeing what it is they've got and see what they read and see what they get to. And, oh, yeah, look at this.
Well, I mean, it's a good insight. It's a good insight into people's character and interests, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And unfortunately, you cannot do that with the e-books on your your Kindle reader. So.
No.
There we go. Never mind. Indeed. All right. Well, we're going to have a special episode this time around. We're going east, I think you might say, Perry. Going to the Eastern Bloc, certainly as it was before the fall of the Soviet Union. And we're going to talk about some books by some Eastern Bloc writers. And the first one we're going to talk about, and we're not only going to talk about the books, we're also going to talk about films based on those books. And so the first one I am going to talk about is a book by, I've got to get this right. I've been practicing this pronunciation for a while, so I'm going to try and get it right. So the writer is Stanislav Lem. Stanislav Lem, that's how I believe it's pronounced. This is based on what's in Wikipedia. Stand to his mates, yeah. Stanislav Lem. Yep, I'm trying hard. Anyway, so this is a book called Solaris, which is probably his best known book because there's been films made of it, I guess. So a little bit of background on himself, Stanislav Lem. He was born in 1921 in a town called Lwów, which was then in Poland. But after the war, the borders shifted. It's now in Ukraine. But we still call him, a Polish writer because he was writing in Polish. He wrote a novel which was published in 1946 called The Man from Mars, which I haven't read. And he went on to write many novels after that. Some of them were autobiographical, but were mostly in what we certainly describe as the science fiction genre. As well as novels, he's published several compilations of stories like The Siberiad, which is all about it's quite an amusing collection of stories about two little robots running around the galaxy. And he's also written several philosophical works. And he became celebrated as one of Poland's leading writers. He's won many awards and was probably, you'd probably have to say, he was the most popular writer of science fiction in the Eastern Bloc before the Strugacki brothers came along. That's my impression anyway. So there's a lot of interesting history about Lem's connection with the Americans and the science fiction writers of America and the American writer Philip K. Dick. But I don't think we've got time to go into that today, Perry, because it's a very complex story.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so Lem died in 2006 at the age of 84. So we're looking at his novel Solaris today, and that was written in 1961. But it wasn't available in English, in an English translation until 1970. And even that was, in fact, a retranslation from the French. Someone had translated it into French, and then someone took that French translation and translated it into English. That version by Joanna Kilmartin and Steve Cox is the version that I own as a book, so that's the one I've read. But I believe there's a much more recent translation by someone called Bill Johnston, which was published in 2011, which is generally regarded as much superior. So I don't want to have to go into a lot of detail about the plot, but I'm kind of going to have to sort of cover the whole story, and it will also set us up for thinking about the films. So Solaris is written from the first-person point of view of someone called Chris Kelvin, and he's traveling to a research station on the planet Solaris. It's not entirely clear to me from the novel what his intended role is going to be at the station. Later on, we discover that he studies psychology, but I'm not clear that that's actually why he's going to the station. Anyway, and the two films differ in how they handle what his role is going to be. So there's quite a lot of detail in the book at the start about the journey that Kelvin makes from the spaceship Prometheus down to the surface of the planet where the research station is located. And though there were once many more scientists at the station, in fact, hundreds at one point, there are now only three researchers left. And they've been at the station for some time, maybe a few years. So Kelvin arrives and gets out of his spacecraft, but he's surprised to find that no one comes to meet him. No one around, and he has to find his own way into the living quarters, where he finally encounters the researcher Snow, Dr. Snow probably is, in the radio room. And they have this really remarkable first encounter because Snow is terrified by the sight of Kelvin. And it takes some time for Kelvin to convince Snow who he is and that he's from Earth. And then Kelvin asks about the other two researchers at the station, in particular Gibarian, who Kelvin had studied with and knows well. And so he's horrified to be told that Gibarian is dead, having apparently committed suicide that very morning. And the third researcher, Sartorius, is locked away in his laboratory and refuses to come out. So after that, it's a really strange introduction to the place. We start to get a lot of background about the planet and why the research is there, why it's of such interest. So it turns out that Solaris is of interest because it's orbiting two stars, and it ought to be in a chaotic orbit. But the planet appears to be actively adjusting gravity to stay in a stable orbit. Now, this is bizarre. So Solaris is covered by a planet-spanning ocean with just a few areas of low-lying land on one of which the station is located. But the ocean isn't merely water. It's active and continually throwing up bizarre and complex, what we call them, constructions, concretions. And over time, the scientists have come to suspect that the ocean is in fact a gigantic living thing, and that's the ocean which is adjusting the planet's motion. Perhaps the ocean's conscious, sentient. So over the period of just over a century, there's a whole branch of science which has developed called solaristic studies, which is dedicated to understanding its behavior and try to communicate with it. And they also sort of create a taxonomy of all the different forms and shapes that the ocean throws up. And there's quite a lot in the book about these studies and the various shapes it throws up and people's interaction with all that. The novel makes it clear that all these efforts have been completely futile, that they really don't understand what's going on. So I reckon that's one of the very interesting themes of this book, the idea that you could come in contact with an alien species, suspect that it's intelligent, yet be utterly unable to understand it or have it understand us. But Kelvin is, back to the station, Kelvin is equally unable to understand what on earth is going on within the station. And he's baffled by the behavior of Snow and Sartorius and by Gibarian's suicide. Snow is unable to give Kelvin any sensible sort of answer. Anyway, the next day, Kelvin is astonished when he's actually been investigating Gibarian's room, and he comes out and he encounters a huge African woman coming down the corridor, naked except for a grass skirt. She comes down the corridor and passes him without saying anything and goes into Gibarian's room. So he queries Snow, what's the heck with this? What the heck is going on? Snow, again, doesn't have any answers that make sense to Kelvin, but it tells him really that he'll eventually understand what's happening. So then Kelvin tries to talk to Sartorius. But at first, Sartorius just refuses to open the door of his laboratory and only agrees to come out on the understanding that Kelvin will promise not to try to get in. And while Kelvin's talking to him, he realizes that Sartorius is desperately holding on to the handle of the door to keep it closed behind him against someone or something which is pulling at it from inside. Eventually, Sartorius breaks off the conversation and cries out, I'm coming," and whisks back inside. Kelvin then sees this huge shadow loom at the door, and there's a struggle, noisy struggle happening within. So he's still baffled, and he returns to his room to sleep. But when he opens his eyes, he sees as though he thinks he's dreaming. He opens his eyes and he sees his young wife, Rhea, who died 10 years ago by suicide at the age of only 19. And so at first he's convinced that it's just a dream, but eventually he becomes more and more aware and realizes that he is in fact awake and that Rhea is really there, which is impossible. But everything about her, how she looks, how she speaks, is a perfect reproduction of this young woman. So he's in this bizarre state of mind, and don't know what, can't understand whether he's gone crazy or he's hallucinating or what's going on. And Rhea herself is vague about how she got there, but she, you know, she talks to him quite sensibly, but she doesn't know quite how she got to the station. And for a while, he asks her where she thinks she is, and she says, "I'm at home with you." But eventually, she lies on the bed, and he decides to examine the soles of her feet. So this is a little quote, looking at the feet of this young woman. "The skin was soft like that of a newborn child. I knew then that it was not Rhea, and I was almost certain that she herself did not know it." So things now make a bit more sense. Each of the scientists on station has received one of these visitors. And they can only assume that the sentient ocean is able to study, somehow get into their minds, and has created these, what we'd call them, simulacra, from what it discovers in the researchers' minds. We never really get a clear understanding of the nature of Snow's and Sartorius's visitors, but I get the feeling that in each case there's a sort of some element of suppressed guilt. You know, there's a feeling of guilt. So Kelvin certainly feels guilt for Rhea's suicide 10 years ago, but convinced that the being he's with isn't really Rhea and is some kind of monstrous imitation, he eventually manages to lure her into a rocket capsule, and he closes the hatch on her. But then the Rhea simulacrum thrashes about with really inhuman force, almost breaking out of the capsule, trying to get out. Nevertheless, he manages to launch her into space on a random orbit. He thinks he's got rid of her, you know, this monster that somehow has arrived. But it's all in vain, as the other researchers tell him, because Rhea appears again in his room. But she doesn't, apparently knows nothing of what he's done to the previous version of her, and knows nothing of that. So despite himself, and he knows that she's not real, but despite himself, he finds himself like falling in love with her again. But she herself, as she becomes more and more aware that she's not truly human, that she's not really Rhea, the situation really becomes quite tragic, and to her becomes unbearable. And she makes another suicide attempt, but her body miraculously heals itself, and she can't die. To me, this is the real heart of the book, the real theme, this tragic situation of this entity, whatever you like to call her, this young woman, this tragedy of being created without knowing why, this awful self-knowledge that she's not the real Rhea, that she's only kind of a shadow of someone that Kelvin was once loved. And then for Kelvin, there's this guilt of knowing that he has, in a sense, created her, called her up, and placed her in this situation, and therefore is responsible for the pain that she's suffering. Anyway, Sartorius eventually finds a way to permanently destroy the visitors, and Rhea goes to him while Kelvin's asleep and begs Sartorius to use this technique on her to literally put her out of her misery, which he does. And when he finds out about this, of course, Kelvin is consumed with grief, but eventually there's a feeling of relief and understanding. And at the end of the book, he travels out onto one of the ocean's mysterious constructions and ponders what's happened to him, and thinking that he's going to remain on Solaris, even not knowing what future horrors the ocean may throw up for him or subject him to. And the closing passages of the book, I think, are a very moving statement of the tragedy of the human condition. And it's really the antithesis of the kind of romantic notion that love conquers all. It certainly doesn't in this case. I don't know, I think this is a real masterpiece of the science fiction genre. It's a great book, and one that most people, I think, who are interested in the genre should read. What about you, Perry? What do you think of it?
I would mostly tend to agree. You know, it's always good to have a little bit of differences. I think that you're quite right about the problem of the human condition and the human identity, and the question of what is it to be human? Are the simulacra really human, even though they've been created theoretically out of thin air? And where have they come from? You get the feeling all the way through this book that there is a purpose behind the simulacra's existence. You just don't know exactly what it is. I kept on thinking all the time that this was an attempt by Well, if we go with the idea that this big ocean is sentient and has a consciousness, I'm of the view that it's trying to communicate to the humans, but can't in any normal manner, the way that you and I would, either by speaking or by radio or by doing something along those lines, can't do that. And so has to have a simulacra that they can utilize to be able to be the communication device. But the point is, they can only get the information about these beings from the humans. And the humans don't know why they're there. And so the simulacra don't know why they're there. And so there's this big sort of first contact communication problem that goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And while the whole concept of first contact is never actually mentioned, if you've read anything in the field at all, it sits over the whole top of this, and you suddenly realise that you're there in a big problem about how do you firstly identify another intelligence that isn't anything like yours, and how do you communicate with them? Now, it's quite easy for you to sit back in this and go, oh, look, this is just silly because, you know, run me through an evolutionary path that would get from a drop of water through to this huge ocean, which is sentient. And I thought about that and I thought, that is a really silly criticism, Perry. That is really, really a weird thing to be asking. It can sit in the back of your head, and I just threw that out because I thought, that's not the whole point of this at all. You shouldn't be thinking about how it actually got there and then dismissing it because of that. It is there, and you have to accept the fact that it's there.
Sure.
So how then do you communicate with it? I thought it was a really good, interesting questions about, as I said, first contact protocols and the morality of what they do, because they start trying to interact with the sea, Solaris. And they've bombarded it with some X-rays. There's a big morality here.
And
especially when one of them says, well, you know, we're not allowed to do this, but we've got to do it anyway.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
What the hell? Not really very good from that perspective. I know that it forces Solaris to say, oh, well, okay, now we can start doing something. But, you know, this is a novel of the intellect rather than action. It's short. I do think it's a major novel in the field. The more I think about this, I gave this 4.0 out of 5, and I'm going to up that, I think. I don't think that's quite right. There are some fairly massive info dumps in this.
Oh, there are.
And you sort of alluded to a bit of that, and I thought that you might have basically given it a few points down on that, because you're not big on info dumps, David, as I recall.
No, I'm not. And you're right. And there's some great slabs of talking really about the solaristic studies and this, what I've called this taxonomy of the various shapes and so on. And it's almost like it's pretending to be an academic work.
Mm.
It's sort of kind of referring to the literature in the field about the behavior of the ocean and these very, very complex constructions it throws up. So, yeah, I think that's fair to say that is a heck of an info dump. But at the same time, I actually think he's making a point with that. And the point really is that human beings can come up with these elaborate theories, this vast complex constructions of their own, theoretical constructions of thought about something, and yet actually not even touch the surface at all of what's actually going on.
Yep.
It's... So I think yes they are a bit tedious, but I think he's making a point with it.
Mm.
It reminds me a little bit in some ways of Borges's work where he has fake books or fake theories that people have come up with. I can't quite cite an exact example now, but it's maybe things like the Book of Sand, where there are inexplicable. This inexplicable book, which people have theories about how it works, or his the Library of Babel sort of thing, but it that's a very slight connection. I'm not going to be too strong on that. So yeah, I thought it was a very interesting book, and I was glad to reread it after many years, I think probably 20 or 30 years since I first read it. And it was good.
It's been a long time since I've read it. And I would have suspected that if I read it back in my teens, I would have hated it. Absolutely yeah. hated it.
I think as a teenager you would have, yeah.
It's not my style. It wouldn't have been my style at all.
Because there's no action, really.
No, nothing.
No, it's really this philosophical study. I mean, there's kind of action in the relationship between Kelvin and Rhea, but it's not really it's not going out there and shooting purple aliens with ray guns, is it? No.
Not that was what I was into all the time back then either, David. But no. this is just people sitting around talking.
Yeah.
You know, and it's basically the whole of the book is set on the space station, or in and around it, and that is something to be remembered as we move into further in this discussion, because that is an important difference between the novel and the films coming up.
Sure.
I believe that this is one of those books that if you want to know what's gone on in the field in the past, I believe that you need to have read this book.
Yep.
And it is quite short. It's, what, 150, 160 pages? If that, it's not a 500 or 600-page brick. You know, you can actually sit down and read this in an afternoon. And if you want to skim through all those info dumps, you can quite easily do it because it's not going to really impact what you're going to get out of the book.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. All right, so now once that book came out, written in 1961, then there have been two movies made based on that. The first one of these was made by Andrei Tarkovsky, the Russian film director, who also co-wrote the script, and that came out in 1972.
Can I just interrupt it just a little bit here? There was... I've done a fair bit of reading around all over the place about this, and there appears to have been a two-part Soviet television black and white program made.
Yep, you're right.
In
yep.
1968, but I can't find it. I don't know whether it's available. I haven't seen it. If I had been able to find it, I would have attempted to watch it for this program, but unfortunately can't find it. Anyway, sorry.
That's right. Yes, there was that. The Solaris was written in 1961. And this film by Tarkovsky came out in 1972. Tarkovsky also co-wrote the script. It stars Donatas Banionis as Kelvin and Natalia Bondarchuk as his wife. Interestingly enough, in this movie, she's called Hari and not Rhea. Never mind.
There are other name changes here too, which I'm not quite terribly sure why.
True, the researcher Snow becomes Professor Snout, is it?
Snout, yeah, which is a bit strange.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really know here whether there's been a translation issue between the Polish and the Russian or something, who knows?
No, maybe the word Snow in Russian was, maybe just it wasn't ever a surname, I don't know.
Yeah, who knows, never mind. Okay, so what do you have to say about this film, and apparently most of Tarkovsky's films, is that it's very slow. It's very, very slow-paced. And it's interesting enough that in Tarkovsky's film, it doesn't start on the way to Solaris. It starts on Earth at the very beginning of the film. And there's quite a long segment before Kelvin gets to travel to Solaris. And at the beginning, he's staying on a farm with, I think Wikipedia says it's his parents. I thought it was his uncle and aunt, but never mind. Whoever they are, they're his relations. And while he's there, they're visited by Kelvin's colleague, Burton, who was on Solaris some years ago and was subjected to a very critical inquiry about his report of an incident he witnessed on Solaris. And partway through, Kelvin and Burton watch a video recording of this inquiry. And the whole purpose of that, I think, is really to give you a pretty good background of this idea of there being solaristic studies. And we see the skepticism with which Burton's report is held, because he reports he was flying over the surface of Solaris in a helicopter, and he sees this monstrously sized human child created by the ocean. It's just among all the very bizarre things it throws up sort of fake replicas of gardens and trees and bizarre geometric constructions. But he reports seeing this monstrously sized human child, which I haven't rewatched the movie recently, but if I recall correctly, it's actually the image of one of the children of one of the other researchers. I think that's right. Anyway, now this event is actually described in the novel, so it's really sort of using this as a mechanism to sort of show you the background of the studies of this weird ocean. And then Burton leaves the farm where Kelvin is, and there's this long, you'd have to say almost interminable sequence. I don't know how long it goes for. It feels like 10, 15 minutes, but it can't be that long. But it goes on and on and on, which is Burton returning presumably to his home in his car, and he's passing along freeways and through tunnels and goes on and on through all these different freeways and roads and tunnels. And eventually you get to a point where the camera sort of pulls back and you see this aerial view of traffic, a big traffic jam, really, in a sort of complex road intersection. I'm not sure how to take all of that. I can only read it as being some kind of metaphor of Kelvin traveling this long distance to Solaris. Maybe a hint that our world, if you saw it with alien eyes from outside, would be as strange and alien as the surface of Solaris is to us. I'm not sure. I don't know how to take that. Anyways, finally we get to the part where we sort of pick up from the book directly. And Kelvin travels to Solaris. And then it sticks fairly closely to the book after that, apart from these couple of name changes we've mentioned. And so I don't think there's any point in really re-describing that. It sticks pretty closely to the book I've already described the plot of. But at the very end of the film, Kelvin appears to have returned to his father's farm, or his uncle's farm, whichever you like. But something odd's happening, sort of, because you see his father or his uncle in the kitchen, and this steaming water is pouring down into the kitchen from somewhere, and his father's not completely unaware of this, not paying any attention at all. And eventually, the camera pulls out, and we see that the farm is really just another simulacrum resting on the surface of Solaris. Solaris has created this whole environment for Kelvin to be in. And that's the end of the movie. So what did you think? I think it's an interesting film, and it's an interesting take, I think, on the book. But what did you think?
One thing that we have to be aware of is that Tarkovsky was very much a very strong Roman Catholic, but he mentions in some interviews that he gave regarding the films that he made, that he never set out to have anything in his films which would be in any way construed of as being a metaphor. Now, I'm sorry, mate, but I don't really care whether you don't think there's metaphors here. There's metaphors all over the place.
Yep.
And this is one of those situations, I think, where, as you all know, David, that it comes across sometimes where artists, novelists, writers, film directors basically are unaware of the final product that they produce. Somebody comes in afterwards and says, oh, you've done this, and this connects over here to that, and that's there. And so this is a metaphor for this. And the reader will go, yeah, well, that's just bleedingly obvious. And the artist will go, well, I didn't put it there. Well, sorry, mate, but somebody did. You may not have known that you were doing it, but it's there. And I think you're right about the idea about that travel all the way right through on the freeways, that he's trying to set up something that gives you the idea of the journey that Kelvin is making, from the idea of he's got this nice environment that he's got on the farm, and then he has to go back into an industrialized complex so that he can actually travel off to this space station, and he has to make that psychological adjustment. But did he have to take so bloody long to do it?
I agree.
The other thing that got me, and which is actually important for other things that we will talk about later on in this particular program, is the amount of water that is there in those first sequences on the farm. There are lots of long shots of a single set piece of reeds in a river, and the current going past, and the reeds just basically drifting. when you get later on and you see the planet Solaris, you go, oh, yeah, okay, that's what he was pointing to. It was alluding to that before him.
Yeah, yeah, so kind of prefiguring it, yeah.
Yeah, but then there's also situations where, and again, he does this in, I've only seen two films, and we'll talk about both of them today, and both of them he has a situation where he, characters will be just standing in a field or standing somewhere, and it just starts to rain.
Yeah.
And then they get out of the rain, and they stand there, and it stops. And it really made me think, is he in a sort of a controlled weather environment? Is this a part of a world where the rain just basically comes on, they turn it on at a certain time and then turn it off after 5 minutes or something along those lines? Or is it just that it happens to rain and that's the way that it rains there? Don't know. But there's a lot of water evolved, and again at the end where the water is dripping down
on top
of books and into the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just everywhere.
There's just water. There's water everywhere.
Yeah.
Except when you get to the station and there's no water there at all because it's completely sort of sterile. Except for the fact that it's filthy. There's
garbage
everywhere.
Which is out of the book.
Which is really quite interesting. But you've got a station where I think they allude to in the book that it could have anything up to sort of 150, 170 people on it.
Yeah.
And it's
got
three. And I keep thinking, who's doing the maintenance on this bloody thing? And really, there's nobody. There's nobody doing this. And you know, there's just nothing there. There's just rubbish all over the place. Now, it's interesting that Tarkovsky made this film, and you have to remember it came out in 1972, 3-4 years at the most after 2001. Tarkovsky hated 2001, and he hated the way that SF was portrayed in Western films, and he called 2001 a lifeless schema with only pretensions to truth. Bloody hell, talk about cutting that to the quick. He really does it. And he what Tarkovsky ends up doing is he just cuts away all the SF stuff in this completely,
yeah,
as much as he possibly can. But even then, he gets to the point where he still had too much of it in there. And one British critic, who I'll talk about later on, actually notes that this was Tarkovsky's least favourite of all of his films.
Yeah,
this is the one that he did not like more than anything. So I gave the film 3.8 out of 5. I thought it was a pretty good, I thought it was a good representation of the book with enough of a change. But I thought that there was far more in the film about the interactions between the people and much less emphasis on what it was that Solaris itself was attempting to do. So there was less of the alien communication and more of, well, you found yourself in this funny position. I mean, what's going on and how are you handling that? And they're talking here with this.
Yeah, well, I think that's true of both films, actually. Both films of Solaris is which I'll talk about the second one in a second.
And, so basically, but there's less. I think that was a product of the fact that Tarkovsky was attempting to get rid of all the SF stuff out of it, which really he couldn't avoid Solaris itself.
No.
But he just used that as a mechanism to get the simulacra there, and then he just did not care where they came from. All he was worried about was what impact that had on the people that were in the station and how they interacted with each other regarding that, and regardless about the first contact protocols, regarding about the morality of what they were doing. None of that mattered about that. It was merely a matter of how did the people interact.
Sure, indeed. All right, so having discussed that one, I'll talk about the second film based on that, which was directed by Steve Soderbergh and was released in 2002. And this one stars George Clooney as Chris Kelvin and Natasha McElhone as Rhea. Here in this one, there's much more emphasis on the idea that Kelvin is a psychologist who is being sent to Solaris to determine, I think he's really going to determine the mental state of the researchers there by direct request of his old friend, Gibarian. So we get quite a lot of background of Kelvin's character and his work as a psychologist. And then we're in a series of flashbacks throughout the whole movie. We get his past relationship with his wife, Rhea, who was portrayed here as much older than in the book, where she's only said to be 19. And I think, again, from his arrival in Solaris, the film follows the novel reasonably closely, but not at all as closely as Tarkovsky's film, which is ironic since Wikipedia says, reflecting on Andrei Tarkovsky's critically acclaimed 1972 film, Solaris, Soderbergh promised to be closer in spirit to Lem's novel. Still, it says, Lem disliked both renderings.
Spirit rather than the actuality, I think.
Yeah. I'm not sure they succeed in this.
No, they don't.
Anyway, so Kelvin arrives, as in the previous, in the book and in the previous film, and he comes into the living quarters. And in this one, he sees numerous smears of dried blood all over the walls. What's going on here? And then he meets up with the character Snow, who's played here by Jeremy Davies. And when Kelvin meets him, he's this young, laid-back, I don't know, gum-chewing young guy, very vague and apparently unconcerned, very, really annoying character, apparently unconcerned by the strange events at the station. And the Sartorius character is now a Dr. Gordon, who's a middle-aged African-American woman, played by Viola Davis. And then at the end, there's a real twist away from the novel, as Kelvin and Dr. Gordon discover a body stashed away behind a panel in the wall. And it's Snow, probably the original Dr. Snow, with the live one they've been talking to being the simulacrum. I assume that's what we're meant to understand. And for reasons I can't now recall, the planet's gravity somehow begins to increase. I think they've zapped it with X-rays or whatever, and it's the planet's gravity now begins to increase, and the station, which had been in orbit, like in the book, it's just sort of sitting on, just above the surface of, immediately above a solid part of the surface. But in this movie, and I think also in Tarkovsky's movie, it's really, they portray it as being in orbit. Anyway, in this movie, at least, the station is being drawn closer and closer to the atmosphere, and it will eventually burn up in the atmosphere or crash to the surface. And Dr. Gordon readies a capsule to escape, but Kelvin at the very last minute decides to stay behind. And then we have this typical happy ever after Hollywood type ending with Kelvin and Rhea reunited, both apparently as simulacra. And I thought, oh no. So look, I didn't like this one anywhere near as much as Tarkovsky's film. But it's interesting that in both films there's very little attention paid to the mysteries of the ocean or discussion, as you said, you know, any talk about the first contact issues or discussion about whether it is actually sentient. We really don't see the ocean much at all, except out of a window, you know, out of the window with a bit of swirling going on. We don't see any of the complex concretions it throws up, which is talked about a great deal in the book. Though at least we do get a description in Tarkovsky's film about some of these constructions that it throws up, but not in the Soderbergh film. So, what do you think of this version, Perry?
It's interesting that this film was produced by James Cameron. He had originally attempted to try and make this film, but just couldn't do it because he was doing a whole lot of other stuff, probably doing Aliens or one of those other ones that he did. And anyway, it looks much slicker and more science fictional than Tarkovsky's. I mean,
yes, that's true.
It's a clean spaceship, this one.
Yeah. Oh, there's rubbish lying around.
But it's not a bit, dirty. But then I thought, who's doing the cleaning? Sorry, this thing sort of pop up into my head.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah, anyway. And look, but it actually delves more into the philosophical problems associated with these, the presence of the visitors. You spoke about the fact that when Rhea turns up in the book and also in Tarkovsky's version, that he doesn't know how to handle this, realises that she's dead, realises that she shouldn't really be there, and convinces her somehow and gets her onto a spaceship, a capsule, and shoots it off into orbit. Well, she comes back in this, and at one stage there's a three of them all sitting around basically talking about what they're really going to do and how things are going to what they're actually going to do with it, with these simulacra. And he looks at about the scene about the midpoint of the film, Kelvin and Rhea are talking to Gordon and Snow, And they're talking about what the visitors are made of and what they're going to do with them. And Kelvin just says, well, we'll take all the findings back to Earth. And Gordon, who seems to spend most of the film in a complete state of distress the whole time, says, what if what's happening here started happening on Earth on a mass scale? Don't you see that as a problem?
Mm.
I think it was a serious mistake to assume it's benign. For all we know, it's driving us crazy so it can watch us kill each other. Now, that's the first time in any of this whole film that anybody refers to anything happening for that. But this is the first time also that you get back to that very much American thing, as far as I'm aware. And it's a very much a modern thing that any alien that you come across is going to try and kill you. So that's the first thing you think of, rather than sort of saying, well, maybe it's just trying to communicate with us. Maybe that's what we should be thinking of. No, they're scared. The weird thing about this is that if you look at all the visitors that each of these scientists get, one of them gets his young son, who's still alive back on Earth and hasn't died. And so he's got his son there with him, but his son also back at home. But it's the son as he remembers his son. Raya is how Kelvin remembers her. And there are problems with his memory regarding that. Gordon, I'm not terribly sure exactly who she has remembered.
No, I don't think we ever see them in the films.
But it scared the bejesus out of her. It really has, and it's really
which is pretty well right with the book, I think, in that you don't find out really about their visitors, but they're obviously not pleasant.
No, but everybody remembers them as. They think they've remembered them. Now, as you said, there are shots on the spaceship, and then flashbacks to where Kelvin meets Raya, meets her first time on a train, and then catches up with her again at a party somewhere, and they start going out, and it sort of keeps on going from there. Basically. Raya, as soon as I saw her, the actress has got this stunning face, absolutely stunning face. And it reminded me of a line, because I must have been listening to this on Spotify over the last month or so. It's a line from a song probably written in the late 80s by Lloyd Cole and the Commotions called Perfect Skin. I don't know whether you remember it, but it's got a line that's got, she's got cheekbones like geometry and eyes like sin. She's got perfect skin. And this woman's face is as that, cheekbones and jaw like geometry. It's just right there. You can understand why they had to up-age the wife in this, because George, as one critic said, George Clooney always looks like he's in a role auditioning for a later George Clooney. Yes. And he's basically playing George Clooney as he thinks he will be later on, so he's looking a bit more serious than he would be. But he's got grey hair. And if you've got grey hair and the wife is 19, you start thinking, this is not a terribly good look here. But there's also differences in this particular film about why they're actually there. You mentioned about the fact that the Institute for Solaristic Studies has been going on for decades in this particular station. It seems to be that somebody mentions that one of the reasons why they're there is they're investigating it as an energy source.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, what the hell are you talking about? It's halfway across the bloody universe. What do you want that as an energy? Anyway, so, this is one of these things that people just, you need to have somebody go through it and go, with a big blue pen, just get rid of that crap. You don't need that at all. Now, as I was talking about how the visitors come in, where you've got Kelvin's got his dead wife, Gilbarian's son comes back. We don't know who Gordon's is. But why does Snow's visitor, himself?
Well, I think he start at the start of early on in the movie, he says that it's his brother.
No, but it's
so you can assume it's his twin brother.
No, I don't think so. I think that he, no, I don't, oh, okay. I must have missed that bit because it really didn't get,
It doesn't make a lot of sense in either way, and the fact that the body of one of them is stashed away doesn't make a lot of sense either. Because this is the first time there's been any violence in any of the, in the book or the other film where there's been any indication that these simulacra are going to be violent in any way, although they're very powerful. I mean, at one point, Rhea tears her way through a metal door, doesn't she?
Yes, so punches a hole through it because she doesn't realise that the door actually opens
the other way.
Now, there's a fair bit about in this particular film, a bit more than the others, about the formation of the simulacra in terms of Clooney's character keeps on saying, she was as I remembered her. And Rhea actually says, but you remembered me as suicidal, and that's what I am. And that's why she tries to kill herself. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. That wasn't picked up somewhere else. That was a nice little point. Now, you know, you may have been able to make that connection yourself, but having it there. But the ending, as you said, I gave this film, I was quite impressed with this film all the way right up, little bits and pieces all the way right through. And about the last 15 minutes, it dropped a whole point for me because the whole ending just lets this thing down considerably. And so Gordon's gone back to Earth. Snow and Kelvin remain on the station, and the station is gradually falling into the planet. And then the film cuts back to Earth again. And we know it's Earth because all of the shots in the space station had a major blue tinge, and all of the stuff back on Earth is more reds and yellows and bits of green as well. But anyway, so Kelvin's cooking in the kitchen and he cuts his finger and he puts it under the water tap. And as he's looking at it in the water, he suddenly realises that it's healed very quickly. So he realises that he's a simulacrum as well, as you said, and that... And then Reyes turns up and Kelvin says, am I alive?
Off we're going to the sunset, yeah.
Am I alive or dead? And Reyes says, we don't have to think like that anymore. And she smiles. We're together now. Everything we've done is forgiven. Everything. And I thought, this is now terrible. This has turned into a semi-religious afterlife fantasy at the end. Everything will be happy ever after, and the Americans can walk out and go, I'm really glad that was an uplifting, and it ruins the whole bloody thing. So without the last 5 minutes of the film, I would have given this a score above 4, but then I gave it down to 3.4. I just thought that, no, it dropped right away. Yeah. It really just ruined it to me.
I think that's right. I certainly prefer the Tarkovsky film, which still doesn't end the way the book does, but it's a good deal more in sympathy with the spirit of the novel. So anyway, there we go. All right, well, I think we've done Solaris to death, don't you?
Well, I think so. It's been a very interesting exercise to both to read the book and then later on to watch both film adaptations. They're all worth having a look at for their own reasons. But be aware of the fact, as you said, that Tarkovsky is a very slow film director, which we will come up to a little bit more in a minute, because we're now going to move on to the short novel, or even probably just a novella, really, Roadside Picnic, which was first published in Russian in 1972, but not translated into English until 1977, written by Arkady and Boris Stragatsky, who you also mentioned earlier on in this particular program. Now, it's interesting that was about here, sometime in the 70s, that some things of Stragatsky's, the Stragatsky brothers, because I've only ever seen them together. Some of their books started coming out into English. And by 1987, they'd been invited to be guests of honour at the World Science Fiction Convention in Brighton in the UK, convention that I went to. And do you know who the other guest of honour, professional guest of honour, was at that convention?
No, I don't.
Doris Lessing.
Oh, wow.
The Nobel Prize winner. So that was interesting. So they had Russians on the one side, and they had Doris Lessing, who was far better known for her literary stuff, but was basically there as a science fiction writer. So that was just something so interesting. Anyway, so getting to this particular book, it's quite quick because I want to talk much more about the film and then the film version than about this. Now, 30 years before this novella starts, aliens have visited 6 different places on Earth, leaving behind debris, junk, various objects in mysterious areas called zones. And people go in and out of these particular zones, a lot of them illegally, although there's an official institute that basically is supposed to be looking after the studies of these zones. But some people go in there and they collect some of these objects and bring them out and sell them on the black market. And these guys are called stalkers. And that ends up being the name of the film that Tarkovsky, made of this particular short novel later on. Mm. Now, the other thing that you need to be aware of is that these zones are theoretically always changing, and they cause long-term medical and genetic changes in the people who enter them. In the first section of the novel, Dr. Valentine Pillman, who's got a Nobel Prize for physics, and don't forget this is sometime in the future, is being interviewed by a reporter from a local radio station and is asked, what in your opinion has been the most important discovery in these 30 years, that is the 30 years of the fact the zones have been there? And Pillman says, the fact of the visitation themselves, I beg your pardon, well, the fact of the visitation itself is the most important discovery in the last 30 years, but also the entire history of mankind, because it's important to know that these visitors were actually here, that there is another intelligence. The reporter is basically, what the hell are you talking about? You know, surely all the little bits and pieces of the gadgets are the most important. But really, it's the fact that this thing actually happened. Now, the book basically follows a guy by the name of Red Shuhart at the age of 23, 28 and 31, as he basically goes in and out of the zone, firstly legally because he's a laboratory assistant with the International Institute for Extraterrestrial Cultures, and then later on illegally. First off, he basically goes in and he goes with a couple of people, friends of his or compatriots of his. He goes in and they get all the stuff they need. They come back out again and they get a really big bonus because they found some really good stuff. Red goes off to the bar. And while he's there, somebody came in and said, oh, by the way, one of your companions is dead. What do you mean? Oh, he died of a heart attack in the shower. Because they have a shower when they come back out again, this guy just doesn't come back out. This is a bit of a shock to Red, so he flees the bar and runs into his girlfriend in the street, who tells him that she's pregnant and her mother wants her to have an abortion because she's worried their child will end up being genetically deformed because stalkers produce mutant children.
Yes.
That's the end of the first section. Second section, he's 28. He's now married with the child, and the only way that he can make money is to go into the zone, retrieving alien objects, bringing them back out again, and selling them on the market. It starts when he's actually in the zone with a friend of his by the name of Burbridge, who's had a bit of an accident, and he's fallen into some, well, I don't know, alien water. It might
alien
be the witch
goo.
Goo of some sort, which has basically turned his lower legs into jelly from the knees down. He doesn't have any bones left. The flesh is still there, but everything underneath is gone. Red gets him out, takes all the swag that they've got. Burbridge tells him about the golden ball. That is the big thing that Burbridge has always been looking for. And says that he knows where it is, and that if Red gets him out and gets him to a doctor so he can get seen to, he'll tell him how to find it. Well, Red gets him out, gets the swag, goes off and sells it, but finds out he's been betrayed by somebody and he's going to get arrested. And he rings up a mate of his, Richard Noonan, who's supervising electronic equipment at the Institute, and says, look after my wife, I'm going to have to give myself up because they're going to come and get me anyway, and they'll just trash the house looking for everything. If I give myself up, that there's a chance that they'll leave her alone and the child alone. So he goes off and he says he's going to get 2 to 3 years. Next section is Noonan near the end of the time when Red has been in jail for 2 years and he hasn't gone back to see the wife. He goes there and goes to see the wife and see Red at the same time. But prior to that, he actually has a bit of a discussion with a friend of his or a compatriot of his. And the guy says to Noonan, when he's talking about what this visitation is, he describes it as being a picnic. It's basically, he says, picture a forest, a country road or a meadow. A car drives off a country road into the meadow. A group of young people get out of the car carrying bottles, baskets of food, transistor radios and cameras. They light fires, pitch tents, turn on the music. In the morning, they leave. And all that crap has been left behind. All the stuff's been left behind. And that's what he says has happened here. The aliens have turned up just on some road through the cosmos, got off the side of the road, had a picnic and just left all this garbage behind. And that's what they're picking up, all this stuff. Red gets out of prison. We realise that there is something wrong with the child in this particular section. We don't know what it is exactly, but it's there. In section 4, we find out that Red basically kisses his child on the cheek, and you find out that she's got gold, her face is covered in golden fur. And it's, so we know that something has gone funny there. We're not just not sure what. In the last section, which is really the sort of the section that the film that we're going to be talking about in a minute is based on, Red's making one last run into the zone to try and find this golden ball. And he's taken another guy with him because he has to get through a particular point called the meat grinder. And what they do is they take somebody who's expendable, somebody that none of them like and they just want to get rid of, because that person that goes first is going to die. And after that person has gone through, then the person behind them can come in and pick up whatever they need. So it's a fairly monstrous way of going about achieving what it is you're going to, you want to try and get. This is a, and then it ends when basically Red gets to the point in a quarry where he's got the golden ball and he's just about to go and pick it up. And then the novel ends. Now, this is a mysterious novel of first contact, again, but also, this time, without the aliens. There are no aliens here. They've been and gone. Yeah. It's quite an interesting story. One thing that some people might would need to be aware of is that we've spoken about this before, David, that some authors in the science fiction field sort of have a conversation with books that have gone before. We've spoken about Anne Leckie with the culture novels of Ian Banks. In this instance, in 2014, Jeff Vandermeer, an American author, wrote his Southern Reach trilogy, especially the first novel called Annihilation, which covers similar ground, and it's about a group of four people in the film version, which starred Natalie Portman. Four women enter this particular area, which is very much like the zone. Parts of it will kill you, parts of it keep changing, things have all gone very weird but you don't know why, but the aliens have been there at some point. This is a conversation with the previous, with this particular book. It's not a, pastiche. It's not plagiarism of any sort. It's just another version and another look at the themes that have gone on.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that you say that, because I have another part of that conversation to talk about.
Yeah.
So I'll do that in a sec. But very quickly, I actually enjoyed this book quite a lot. It was good. I thought it was well written. But in terms of the conversation, it reminded me enormously of Ogis Boudreaux's Rogue Moon. Because if you recall in that, which was written 11 years earlier in 1960, and Roadside Picnic was written in 1971, in Rogue Moon there's this very strange construction they discover, which happens to be on the moon in Boudreaux's book. Very strange area. It's lethal. If you try and get into it, people get killed as they try to navigate their way through this object. There's no, it's clearly of alien origin, but there's no aliens around. There's been some sort of visitation. So I thought that was a very interesting interesting to pick that up. Now, whether the Stragatskys had read Rogue Moon, no idea. But it's not, even if they had, it's not plagiarism. It's just picking up this similar sort of idea of this. And it's also the case in Cyrus too. It's this unknowable alien. which we just deal with in a way with its with the peripheral results of what it does or what it's left behind it, and we never get humans are never able to fully understand it, and that's certainly the case in both Rogue Moon and in Roadside Picnic. So anyway, that's really all I have to say. I don't think there's anything much more I've got to say about the book, but then we move on to the film that was based very loosely, I would have said. You'll talk about that.
I will.
On the book.
Yeah. Now, we've got another film directed by Andrei Tarkovsky. This one in 1979, and it's called Stalker, taken from the name of the people that go through this the zone. It was written by the Stragatsky brothers in consultation with Tarkovsky. Made in Russia, has a lot of Russian actors' names in it. I don't think I'll basically give you the nod. I should have mentioned that the Internet Movie Database has a listing, a rating that people could write in and basically give their particular films. The original Tarkovsky Solaris had a rating of 8.1. This Stalker has a rating of 8.2. So mm-hmm. It's sort of fairly similar. Now, I've got to tell you that I had a very weird experience with this particular film over the weekend. I spoke to you about this, David, I think. A friend of mine, friend of the podcast, W.H. Chong, told me about a particular book called Zona. The full title is Zona, a book about a film about a journey to a room, that's the title, by Jeff Dyer, published in 2012. That was published in Australia by Text Publishing. Now, this is a book... Jeff Dyer, who I actually alluded to a few times in Solaris when I said a British film critic, that's who I was talking about, but I didn't want to give his name until I got to this point because, anyway, you know what it is. You don't want to basically sort of give the whole story before you get to it. His whole book revolves around a viewing of this particular film. He works his way through the 142 cuts in this film. Now, firstly, somebody went and counted them, which mm-hmm. I think is good from my perspective. I wouldn't want to, but he works his way through every one of the 142 cuts. And I've watched maybe the first 15 minutes of this particular film just to get a bit of a feel for it. I thought, oh, God, this is going to be long and slow because it's 2 hours, 46 minutes, this one. Mm-hmm. And I came across Zona... picked up a copy, started to read it, and then I thought, this might be an interesting exercise if I watch a bit of the film and then read what Dyer's got to say about it, maybe read on a little bit, and then do overlapping all the way right through, which is what I did the whole of yesterday, which was good because wow. It was freezing cold here in Melbourne, and I was able to sit and do that with one laptop showing the movie and one laptop where I've got the book on an e-reader. And it was a very, very strange experience. I think that I have no idea whether it completely changed my view of the film or not. Anyway, we'll get there. So the film differs markedly from the book in that it really only concerns that very last section, and it takes that last section of the novel where the stalker, and he's only ever called the stalker in this film, he's not given any other name at all. He earns his living by taking people into the zone. Now, there's also a change in that there's no golden ball that is going to give people lots of wishes and give them whatever they want. In the film, the area where you can go and get your deepest desires fulfilled is just called the room, and everything is in capital letters here. So the film starts with the stalker waking up in bed. He's lying in bed with his wife and his daughter. He basically gets up, gets dressed. Bloody, it's the whole film is in this part of it is completely sort of in a sepia wash. Yeah. I found out later on that what they've done is they filmed it all in black and white. They filmed it all in colour, but they printed it in black and white, and so they put this sepia wash over it all the way right through. God, to use an expression, the area in which he lives is a shithole, David. It's garbage everywhere. There's But it's not garbage like bits of plastics. It's industrial waste. You've got, you know, big hunks of steel that are rusting over here. You've got puddles of oily water and bits and pieces of equipment that are just lying around all over the place that he has to go over. You know, half burnt logs of wood lying on the road and all this sort of stuff. It's just awful.
You're talking about the area around where he lives.
Area around where he is. And he gets into the... he goes to meet after he gets up, and his wife is really annoyed that he's actually going off to the zone again. He goes off to a bar and he meets the two people that he's going to take there who try to introduce themselves. And he says, no, you're the writer and you're the professor. So there is a professor and the one's the writer. They've both got their own reasons for wanting to go into the zone. The writer says that he's completely lost inspiration for his work and he needs to be able to go and find it again. And the professor gives some story about how he just wants to go in and see what's there and do some measurements. There's a beautiful sequence in the book about the bar. Oh, God, it goes on for about 20 pages, and it's fantastic. It goes into the flickering light that's there, the grubby barman that comes out and pouring the beers. It's just wonderful stuff. They leave there, and then they go to get into the zone. And to get into the zone, they have to take a Jeep. They do a bit of a zigzag around, being chased by a motorbike. The only way to get into the zone, which is in this particular version, is completely surrounded by a very high wire fence with guard posts and guard and gates. And the gates are there to allow trains to go through the area. The only way for the stalker and his mates to get through is to follow a train through the gate and try to make sure they don't get shot by all the guards. Once they get in far enough, the guards won't follow them because they don't want to go anywhere near the zone at all. So we're still on the outside, but there's a buffer area before you get to the zone. And so the three men get onto this small diesel-powered cart, and as they're going along, there's a long sequence of the camera just sitting on them. Dyer says this is one of the greatest sequences in cinema ever.
Wow. Okay.
Which I thought was a bit of a stretch. But anyway, it was interesting. But then it just changes, and suddenly you're in colour.
Yes.
You move from the sepia straight into colour. It's a beautiful way of making that big jump. You don't know when it's going to happen. It just happens.
Mm. So not all that original. Remember Wizard of Oz?
True. But Tarkovsky, or Dyer, says he's never seen Wizard of Oz. And he's okay. Aware of that. He knows that it's there. But he's never seen it and he doesn't want to see it.
Mm.
I don't know whether Tarkovsky had seen it. Maybe. But anyway, it's a good break.
It's a good technique, yeah.
And then so they start moving through the particular zone itself. Now, the stalker all the way right through keeps on saying, you've got to be careful, everything's got to change. Things change in a hurry and you have to keep up with everybody and you have to keep, sticking together. And it's a divey place. There's water and mud and stuff everywhere. And yet nothing ever changes in the zone. You never see anything. In the book, in order for the stalker to know whether he can move from one particular point to another, because gravity sometimes changes in the area in front of him, he gets a large bolt from a steel nut, and he ties a ribbon around it and throws it. And if it looks like it goes in a dead straight line and lands the way he thinks it should land, he can walk through there. But sometimes he throws it and it just either veers off to one side or doesn't land properly or shoots up or goes in a different direction, doesn't want to go in that way because there's something there that's going to impact them. Every time he throws a nut in the particular film, it goes exactly where he wants it to go. So you never know whether anything happens. There's a few little pieces where a bird appears and then disappears and then another one turns up straight afterwards, but you don't know whether that's an illusion or you've missed something. But that's it in terms of what goes on in this. But the three of them all head towards, they have arguments, they have discussions about where they're going. They seem to do a heck of a lot of lying down in puddles of water, which I don't quite understand.
Yes.
Again, there's water everywhere. We were talking about that in Solaris. There's water everywhere.
Yeah.
And guys doesn't seem to bother them. In Solaris.
They go to sleep. The stalker goes to sleep in this pool of water.
In Solaris, Kelvin's walking through rain and it just doesn't bother him. He sort of flicks his head and that's it. Here, they're always going through this stuff. Anyway, stalkers always tell him, you have to stay together. Things change and You know, you get lost. And if you get lost, we can't go back the way we came. Okay, all right. We have to keep on going all the way right through. So I thought, oh, bit of a problem about the Jeep then. We've left that one behind.
Because they send that back.
But the Jeep themselves, when they drive through, then get on to...
They
get onto the diesel cart and they're able to put that in reverse and send that back.
Yeah, send that back off.
So that's okay, but the Jeep...
The actual Jeep
stuck there. Anyway, so basically they end up working their way through and go further and further, heading towards the room. And they pass through a long, wet and mossy tunnel that the stalker calls the meat grinder. Well, this is the equivalent of the meat grinder in the book. And the meat grinder, I believe, was the slang term given to the Soviet gulag, that if you went in there, it was like a meat grinder and that you were going to be ground up. Some people came through it, but not many others did. So there's always, with Russian novels, a fair bit of point about politics, but not politics in the way that you and I understand it. It's the politics of the bureaucracy around you and the overriding the police apparatus that's there. And so they're always thinking about whether they're going to get in trouble, whether they're going to get shot, whether they're going to get arrested and so on. Now, halfway through this, a dog turns up. Don't know what the hell the dog's doing there, but the dog turns up and sort of pops around here and there. And sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't, but it keeps on coming back. And they all finally work their way through, because you can't go in a dead straight line. The stalker says the room's 200 metres in that direction, but we can't go that way. We've got to go around here. An hour and a half later, after I've gone through all of this stuff, and they get to the room outside the room, they finally all get there together. And it's then that you come to the understanding that the writer doesn't really want to go into the room because he's now scared of getting inspiration back again. But the professor, who's been carrying this knapsack with him all the time and causing all sorts of frictions because he's been leaving it behind and then has to go back and get it, and he's got his thermos and his sandwiches in it, pulls out something else which looks like a thermos flask. And when somebody says, "What's that?" as he starts to unscrew it and fix it all up and pulls something out of his pocket and slips it in, says, "Oh, it's a 20 kiloton bomb, which I'm going to use to blow this room up." And there's a big scramble with the stalker and everything. And the writer actually steps in between the professor and the stalker and throws the stalker into the water. And he keeps on throwing him into the water. The stalker gets up and he chucks him back into the water again. Something about water with Tarkovsky. I don't care whether he doesn't think there's metaphors or not, but there's something there. Now, anyway, in the end, the stalker basically gives it up because he thinks, I can't stop this guy. And he says to the professor, "Why are you doing this?" "Well, it's a matter of, I don't want anybody or idiots to come here who want to get their heart's desire in this particular room, which would be to gain power and rule the world. So I'm going to blow it up." And they talk a little bit. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, he thinks, "Nah, I'm not going to do that anymore." And then starts unscrewing and disassembles the bomb, throws it. I thought, gee, that was pretty quick. 1 minute he's actually sitting there and he's actually got it almost to the point where he's just about to punch in the combination at the top to arm this particular bomb. And he just decides, "No, I don't want to do that anymore. All right, I won't." And so he's got a change of heart. And they sort of sit there a bit and they look into the room and it starts raining in the room in a puddle. There's a puddle of water in the room. Puddle, half a lake, the tiled floor of the room, the capital R room, where they're all trying to get to, it's got a tiled floor and it's got, 10 centimetres of water or 15 centimetres of water in it. And it starts raining inside the room as the camera pulls back toward away through the room at the back. So you're looking at the three of them looking into the room. And then the rain stops and they're still sitting there and they're still sitting there and they're still sitting there. And then the film cuts. And then we're back to sepia and we're back in the bar again. And the three guys are standing in exactly the same spots as they were at the start of the film. You look and you go, "Oh, hang on, the dog's there." So they did actually go through the zone. So the dog's there. Right. And the stalker's feeding the dog. And then the wife turns up and then they basically have a bit of a discussion, and then the stalker heads off back with the wife. They go back. he has a bit, he collapses on the floor in a philosophical funk of some sort. She puts him to bed and then has a bit of a discussion directed to the camera about what it is that she's done. And then it cuts again to a colour shot of the
monkey.
The monkey.
Well, sorry, monkey is the name,
the
of,
name,
the
name of the child. Seemingly walking. But as the camera pulls back, you find out that she's sitting on her father's shoulders and they're walking around and walking through. And they go off camera. And then it cuts to the girl sitting at the end of a table reading a book. She's just reading a book and the camera pulls back and pulls back. Oh, that's the other thing. Tarkovsky likes to have... He likes to keep his camera in motion. It doesn't sit in one place all the time. It slowly works its way in or slowly works its way out. And it's so slow, it's almost imperceptible. But you suddenly realize, we're moving back. We're getting a wider shot here. So we get a wider shot of her sitting at near the table. And on the table, there are three glass containers. I think there's two glasses in a jar. And she finishes the book, and there's a voiceover of some verses. She puts the book down and puts her cheek down on the top of the tabletop and looks down the table. And as she's doing that, one of the glasses just starts to slide down the table and goes all the way to the end. And then the jar starts sliding, goes all the way to the end. And then the last glass goes all the way to the end and falls off the table, but doesn't break. You hear it clink, but it doesn't break. And then all you get is the top of the table with her face looking down, glass and jar on either side, and it fades to black and it finishes.
Yep.
And you think, he stripped every single piece of science fiction out of this film, this particular story, until right at the very end.
Yeah,
and then
that's
he's
right.
just put that bit in. To me, I mean, it's a very interesting ending. I was really impressed with the ending. And overall, I was very, very impressed with the film. I know you probably have a different view. I gave this 4.6, which rounds up to 5. I thought it was an excellent film. But David, the one thing that I don't know, would I have given it the same value if I hadn't been reading Dyer's book at the same time? And Dyer's book is at times incredibly funny. He has some really funny observations and he brings a whole lot of things in all over the place. And you go, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about it. Well, no, I disagree with that. But it's like having a conversation while you're watching the movie. And it was really very, very bizarre, but a very interesting experience. But I could never do it again.
No.
I'd never seen the film before and I'd never read this particular book before. But having them together is a once-off experience in my life because I can't do it anymore. It's done. But it was very interesting to do.
Interesting.
What do you think of it?
I didn't like it. It has been very well received critically, so I'm obviously missing something. There's something I'm not getting, but I found it unbearably tedious. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. It lasts forever. And the good things I can say about it, I suppose, is it kind of reminds me a bit of absurdist plays, you know, Samuel Beckett, things like Waiting for Godot and whatever that Beckett play is, where the three men in rubbish bins sitting, you know, they're all in rubbish bins and they're talking deep philosophy to each other. Because there's a lot of that. All they do is wander around this landscape and talk philosophy or talk about things in the world. I don't know. And as you say, he has stripped out all the alien stuff out of it. As they go through this zone, this wilderness and this industrial wilderness, there's nothing actually alien in it. All you have is the stalker's words we've got to go this way. You know, people don't go that way. We're going to have to pass through the meat grinder. Oh my God, he's gone the wrong way. But we never see any implications of going the wrong way. You know, the writer does walk off and go the wrong way, but nothing ever happens to him. The professor gets told you mustn't stay behind. You can't go back for your knapsack. But he goes back and picks up the knapsack. And then after a bit, the writer and the stalker come back to where the professor is sitting there having his lunch. And you think, okay. So really, you know, there is absolutely nothing else. There's nothing other than the stalker's word that there is this alien things or dangerous things are actually going to happen. So, well, maybe that's what we're meant to see in that, and maybe that's right. So that was interesting. I would never watch it again. It's not something I'd want to watch again. I think I can see what some people see in it, but I didn't see it. Not directly. I just found it very tedious and went off. And it really has very little to do with the book. In fact, there's a quote in Wikipedia. According to Tarkovsky in 1979, the film has basically nothing in common with the novel except for the two words stalker and zone. That's not quite exactly true, but it's pretty close.
It's pretty close. You're right, because the only way that you know that there may be any reason for this whole thing is that the authorities have blocked it all off. So that gives you the idea that there's something going on. But once you get into the zone, it's all the word of the stalker. And nothing that happens in the book.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
At all validates anything that he's got to say. And when they turn up to the room, which is going to give everybody their heart's deepest desire, well, the only one that he ever talks about is a guy that he calls the porcupine that went in there, came back out, and a week later got very rich. But he went in with the idea that he wanted to get his brother back, didn't get his brother back, got a whole lot of money, got rich, realised that he'd sent his brother to his death at some point in there, and hanged himself.
Yeah.
Well, you can actually get rich just by buying a lottery ticket. That may have been what happened. And so is there anything other than chance that's evolved with all of this? We just don't know. You just don't know. It is a very interesting film, but as you say,
it's very interesting. But
I don't think I don't think
I didn't enjoy it.
I don't. I enjoyed it. I don't think I will subject myself to it again. There are some people like Dyer, the guy that I was talking about that wrote the book. He seems to have seen it about 40 or 50 times. Some people are fixated on this particular thing, and I'm not entirely sure why.
Yeah, and it seems to be very well regarded critically, but there's something missing in me that I don't care. The one thing I would like to say about it is that all of these books we've been talking about and the two Tarkovsky films were all written under the Soviet system. And must have been constrained by the requirements of Soviet censorship. In fact, there's an interesting afterword to my copy, which is an ebook of Roadside Picnic, where Arkady Strugatsky talks about the years long struggle to get the book published through the Soviet system, and all the compromises he kept being forced to make. And still having it rejected by the Soviet system, so that's interesting. So, it'd be interesting to know what sort of influence that had on the making of the writing of the books and the making of the films.
Lem said that he disliked Tarkovsky's version of Solaris. Said he hadn't made the book; he'd made Crime and Punishment. Which actually is really quite good. It's really perceptive. And he heard about Soderbergh's version, but had heard only enough about it to realise that he wasn't going to watch it and condemned it anyway. Okay. And, of course, the Strugatskys were involved with the Tarkovsky version, but I gather he demanded endless rewrites, and it was the whole production was a complete disaster. They lost two film directors. One of them walked off the job because there'd been a problem with the film and it was all just hadn't developed properly, or something was a real big problem, and they had to redo it all. So, you sort of think though that given the way the film goes, that you should really have been able to do the filming in around about half an hour longer than the 2 hours 46 minutes. I'm being facetious, but there's not. It's just straight stick the camera there and let the guys do their bit. That's really it. There's no special effects. There's nothing here except for the film development. So either the sepia coloured black and white or the colour. That's it.
Yeah, and that does work well as a transition between. I mean, it's really the zone, and really from the stalker's point of view, the zone is the real world. You know, it's the place where he comes alive and the world comes alive for him, whereas everything else is this dreary, dingy sort of room that it lives in, and the industrial environment, which is really depressing.
It's polluted. So, it's just the worst place you could possibly want to try and live. You don't think anything can grow there.
Yeah. Whereas the zone is full of life, of plant life and bird life and so on. And so it is kind of the real world. In fact, there's an interesting scene right at the very beginning, once they get into the zone, where the stalker goes off and leaving the writer and the professor sitting on the diesel next to the diesel track. And he literally sort of goes off and wants to commune by himself, and he literally throws himself into the grass and lies face down as though, you know, I'm hugging this as, you know, this is my love. And you can sort of see that. So that was interesting, I thought.
The greens are very green and the blues are very blue in the zone.
Yeah, yeah.
And elsewhere outside it's monochrome.
Yeah,
and I think that's the big thing that he's trying to tell you, that, you know, there are greater things to see out there than we need to. But, of course, Tarkovsky said he's not trying to tell you anything. All he's trying to do is tell you a story. Well, there's a whole lot of other things I could have talked about. There's a crown of thorns in there somewhere.
Yes, the writer puts this on his head, yeah.
You cannot put a crown of thorns into a film without there's only one thing that it leads to. There's only one thing. In the whole of Western culture or the whole of human culture or civilization, as Dyer said, it's a hat that basically doesn't fit very well and doesn't keep you dry and doesn't keep the sun off. It's a crown of thorns, and that's all it is. And so it's a metaphor. Sorry, mate, but that's what it is. Anyway, look, it's been a very interesting exercise to watch the films and read the books. But I don't think we'll do it again for a while. It was a bit intense for a little while. Let's get back to just reading a few interesting books. So
we'll just talk about what we'd be reading.
Yeah, I think we'll do that next time, David. I think that sounds good. Righto.
Okay, well, we'll wind up there, and thanks a lot, Pat.
No problems.
And we'll see you all out there in a couple of weeks.
See you then.
Thanks for listening.
No worries.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.